So we have a few minutes. If anyone has any questions, come on up. There's a microphone there, and there's one over there on that side if you have a question for Dr. Cantor.
While we're waiting for people to come, please come to the microphones. Thank you very much for that response. And when you said it could be all kinds of industries and products and services, I didn't talk about the healthy cement example. But one of my vanguard companies is Cemex, which is a Mexican cement company, now number one or number two in the world, that has had to innovate in order to differentiate itself. And one of its innovations is antibacterial cement, which is really good for hospitals, but it's also really good for any place where infections can reign. And it's, again, a commercial product invented by companies that's thinking about how to sell cement. So we just infuse this consciousness wherever we can, and we'll worm our way into the companies. Now, so I'm here, I'm standing here just giving you a chance to think about what you want to say. So I would love to hear from you.
Hi, Rose, great talk. Dave Sparling, University, Ivy Business School. I'm really interested in what motivates companies. What starts this? How do companies all of a sudden, do they make a leap into this? Do they, does it start with sort of looking at all their values? How do companies sort of move from where they've been in the past into this sort of status?
Great question. I mean, some are born with it, but that doesn't mean they don't lose their way. I mean, Procter & Gamble is 170 some odd years old and has always had a strong culture. But, you know, companies can lose their way. I think in the 21st century, there's been a renewal in those companies that have had strong cultures or sense of values, and there have been reasons that other companies have come on board. So when I started with the beer that solves social problems, I said that that parent company, in a sense, was newly formed from a merger, and they had a chance to start fresh and say, how do we motivate and guide our people from who've come from two different companies all over the world? Well, we're going to have to find some principles we hold in common. And so there's an active search for that now. And as we become more global and people have to work together virtually or for real across borders and boundaries, the need for some kind of social glue or common platform or way to communicate has grown. So that also motivates people. Then, you know, we're all aware of these problems. I mean, I thought it was illuminating and inspiring to hear a presentation again about inequities in the world. I've been hearing them for a long time. These have been, the surfacing of these problems has become greater and greater and much more in the public awareness. And so for the millennium, the UN talked about UN millennium goals and so forth. So this has been rising through the 90s, some consciousness that we can't hide from the problems of the world and that what goes on in one country is going to affect people's employees in another country as well. And so once you put all those forces together, including the values of the new generation of workers, you begin to have a powerful combination that leaders who are smart look at and say, we want to tap this.
I have a question for you.
Do you want to identify yourself? I thought that was cool.
In the past decade, we've seen the tenure, particularly in the United States, of CEOs shrink and shrink and shrink. Much as people speak of the long term, they seem to deal with the current quarter. What common thread have you found, if any, amongst these successful companies has allowed them to stem the tide of the shareholders, the institutional investors, and the like who are pushing for the immediacy in initiatives that are perhaps a little bit more long term in nature?
Again, another excellent question, because we know the pressures for short-termism And we also know that whenever there are problems, throwing out the CEO sometimes is the usual thing to do, and it's often the good thing to do if you need a fresh start. But it then makes it hard if you have a succession of CEOs to take hold of a strategy for change that's longer term. So what these companies do, first of all, they have to have a longer time horizon embedded in the minds of top people and the board, that they're not always going to every quarter be the best. But IBM's been beating expectations, but they're careful to balance that with the long-term investments. You know, R&D, research and development, is a legitimate investment for companies. And in fact, if companies don't do enough of that, they sometimes get punished by the financial community, because that's the investment in the future. So I think that this kind of project is another form of R&D. It's learning from society and on the ground, and can be justified not because of the immediate commercial returns, but because of the long-term learning. What P&G, and so P&G knows how to talk to the analysts about this. What they got out of Children's Safe Drinking Water as a nonprofit that they set up, first of all, they got huge acclaim and awards, but so much longer that later that you couldn't, you know, take that to the bank. They got employee loyalty because employees said, the company has integrity. It does what it says. So they get more engagement, more motivation, faster work. They also know how to talk to the analyst community. So the new CEO of P&G, and I'm sorry to answer the question through a story, but stories are more memorable. The new CEO of Procter & Gamble, Bob McDonald, recently talked to the analysts because he came in July. In August, he announced that their new growth strategy for the business is called purpose-inspired growth, improving more lives that we don't even know about in more places. They're going after the developing world big time. He was going to talk to the analysts about that on a day when we happened to be together in the afternoon, financial analysts. And his investor relations people sort of whispered to him, you know, Bob, hold down that heart thing about purpose. You know, just talk to them about the numbers. So he did what he wanted to. He talked to them about purpose-inspired growth, but he gave them the numbers. He said, there are 7 billion consumers in the world, and right now, on average, they buy $14 a year of Procter & Gamble products. If we can just find a few more needs that we serve and a few more lives that we improve, you know, just get that average up to $16 per person per year, he said, that's a huge market. So it is longer term. They do have to run the business effectively in the short term, but not necessarily squeeze everything out of it. They have to be reserving for investment. And if you've got a plausible rationale, then you can sell that to the financial community. Sam Palmisano says, I won't read you the quote from the book, but the IBM chairman and CEO says, management is temporary, returns are cyclical, we won't do as well every quarter as everyone would like, he said, but we'll do well in the long term, and the only thing that holds us together is our culture. So we have to keep investing in that. So they have that attitude, and they can sell it to the financial community and often outperform expectations. So they're not necessarily the high flyers. One other financial, for those of you who do care about the finances, let's see. You mentioned, Mr. Bloom, you mentioned the bank in Brazil, Banco Real. Banco Real, 10 or 12 years ago, started out with their banking strategy being social and environmental responsibility. And they said, we're not a green bank, a charity bank. We're going to find those places where our contributions are going to make us money. They did micro-lending in the favelas, the slums. They were the first to trade carbon credits. They did a lot of good things. Reduced accidents of the bike messengers in São Paulo. And if you've ever been on the streets of São Paulo, it's really dangerous. So they're doing all these good things. They're performed, they're back of the pack bank when they start. 5 years into it, their financial performance is looking okay and they're growing. It's not there yet. 6 years into it, they're shooting ahead, up to the point where they became the third largest and in many say the most admired. Now they're the second largest because they are now Santander Brazil, and they were rewarded. And I'll just tell you this quickly. A couple of weeks ago, Barack Obama was awarded the Nobel Prize, Nobel Peace Prize. But 2 days before that, Banco Real, now Santander Brazil, was rewarded with what I call the Nobel Prize for having a noble purpose. That was my little play on words. And here's the prize. They went public. They floated 14% of the company. It became 18% because it was oversubscribed in the world's largest public offering in 18 months. Not Brazil's, but the world's. It was floated in São Paulo and the New York Stock Exchange, and they got $8 billion of new capital to invest. Now, the investors aren't investing because they say, oh, it's a do-good bank. They're investing because the bank is profitable, but they see that the culture and the leadership are what is going to produce the next wave of innovation, as all the other banks in Brazil are now starting to copy them. So that's a pretty powerful story and reward, and I'd rather the money go to those banks who earn it than the ones who are artificially propped up for whatever reason. But you can get rewarded in various ways in the marketplace for doing this. You do also have to be producing results pretty steadily, but not always at the highest level. So thank you for that question. That's the perfect question. You know, it's interesting when I talk about this. Yeah, I'm coming to you. When I talk about this, I have to answer the question from both ends. From the people concerned about society, I have to prove that these businesses aren't pulling some fast one. You know, it's not a trick. And then from the people concerned about business, I have to prove that it pays off. So if both happen, that's good. Yes, sir.
We have time for one more. Okay. Michael Churchill Smith, medical doctor, McGill. This ethos change that you describe, Sabe, is somewhat, and I assume you can't define a specific trigger for it, that it's been the forces of change over the last 20 years. Do you see it translating itself or trickling down to middle size and smaller companies that are not necessarily under or have the room or the capacity for sort of areas of change or shall we say longer term profitability,
right,
and therefore globalizing itself at that level? Do you see that happening?
Yes. So that's another really great question. And by the way, I do see it happening to some extent faster among the best companies in the emerging market countries because they do care about their country. But yet that's a great question. Here's how it trickles. First of all, it trickles because some new companies and smaller and growth companies start this way to begin with. They may have a family at the start of the enterprise that actually has values and cares about how they operate. They may start with the premise that if you're not showing you're doing good for the world, you shouldn't be in business. Like Seth Goldman, who started Honest Tea, which is an environmentally sound green tea that's healthy and supports community causes and was just invested in heavily by Coca-Cola, who may see that sugar water is not as sustainable as green tea, bottled green tea. But so there are small companies who start that way. But the other way it trickles is I talked about World Community Grid deliberately because of the partnership. So what these companies do is they also treat their suppliers more like partners, and they try to spread their standards to their suppliers and their distributors because they're very dependent on them these days. IBM's only going to grow in China because it's going to create hundreds of business partners among small IT shops all over the second-tier cities. And so what these companies do is they train their suppliers and distributors, and they engage them in community service as a form of bonding. Cemex, the Mexican cement company, does that with small hardware stores in Mexico. So they are a force. I started with the HMO in Egypt because saying force for raising standards in countries, force for raising standards among domestic companies too, if they work with them in a positive way. Now, there are still some companies that exploit their suppliers, but small and medium-sized businesses are on board, and sometimes they're more on board than the giants. And I could give you more examples of that, but I think you're tired and have to start early in the morning. Thank you very much.